More than 400 correspondents around the world came and had a look on these elections. And I don't think that none of them had something to do about these elections.
Would you give the Viet Cong an opportunity to participate in the political processes that you're now creating?
There is only one problem. The Communist Party is outlawed the way the Communist Party is outlawed here in the state.
Almost one in every five men in uniform, if the figures are accurate. The men say that they deserted because they were tired of the endless war, or because they wanted to be with their families, or they wanted to try for one of the highest salaried jobs in Saigon, or because they were afraid.
Khi nằm đó, tôi nghĩ thì trong hậu cứ báo cáo từ đầu ngũ.
The reason he deserted because he was wounded one time. And then after he spent a certain time in the hospital, he was returned to the battalion for working at the battalion. And he feel he doesn't like the job, and then he desert again. This man desert because he believed that his platoon leader is a pro-VC personnel.
His platoon leader is pro-Viet Cong, and he's anti-Viet Cong, and so he deserted.
He deserted. That's correct.
Every midnight after curfew, the Saigon police put out their dragnet searching for deserters and draft dodgers, men who've gone back to their families, men who hide under beds, inside bureaus, behind locked doors, in attics, men who want to escape the service of their country. Just a year ago, only one out of every four Vietnamese fighting battalions was able to operate because their ranks were so depleted. It was an emergency demanding emergency measures. And the American advisors finally persuaded the Vietnamese high command to make some changes. First of all, a tough new anti-desertion law was passed. A first offender must serve at least 5 years at hard labor with combat or combat support units under the most austere conditions, the law says. For repeaters and for men who desert under fire, the penalty can be death. But just as important, the commanders finally began to understand they had to change the living conditions of the Vietnamese GI. Traditionally, the soldier has lived on the base with his wife and children. The Americans have a name for these dependents' quarters. They call them squalor holler. Garbage strewn about, open sewage. They are disease breeders, morale killers. Little by little, those shacks are being replaced by simple, nondescript, but clean frame buildings with septic tanks outside, cement floors, tin roofs. It makes a world of difference to the families who live in them. The soldiers' pay was raised, though it is still minuscule by U.S. standards. They're improving the PXs and the commissaries so the soldier can buy his cigarettes and soft drinks, his rice and sugar, at a decent price. They're even planning a community television installation when a TV set becomes available. Last year, there were 23,000 desertions during Tet, the Vietnamese New Year holidays. This year, that figure was cut in half.
Were you worried about a year ago? Were the people down here worried because the desertion rate was so high?
Yes, I think there was a tremendous problem here. I think it's evident in the records that we have on the desertion rate. Of course, as you know, there are some periods when the rate is a little higher, particularly during Tet. But this year, there has been a tremendous decrease in the rate of desertions because of the efforts that are being made to improve the soldiers' lot.
They're awarding more decorations to enlisted men, not just to officers. There were only 12,000 deserters in January and February. It's a figure the military authorities find reassuring. The trend is sharply down, they say. But the number of deserters is half again as large as the number of Viet Cong defectors who rallied to the government side during those 2 months under the Chu Hoi Open Arms Program. The authorities here, Vietnamese and Americans, say publicly that the recent sharp decline in desertion rates indicates the Vietnamese fighting man has a new enthusiasm for his government and a fresh determination to win the war. But privately, they say something else. Privately, they admit it's the tough new anti-desertion law that's made the difference. That and the dawning realization among his commanders that the Vietnamese GI is a human being. Mike Wallace, CBS News, at Lam Son Base.
May 3rd, 1967.
As the focal point of this struggle in Asia, the Republic of Vietnam Armed Forces merit special attention. Before 1954, South Vietnam had no armed forces in being, and there was no tradition of military leadership. The requirement to build an army, navy, and air force in the face of enemy attack and subversion seems in retrospect as almost an impossible task. Yet, in their determination to resist the communists, the Vietnamese have built an effective military force. What I see now in Vietnam is a military force that performs with growing professional skill. During the last 6 months, Vietnamese troops have scored repeated successes against some of the best Viet Cong and North Vietnamese Army units. Perhaps more important in this total effort is the support given by the Vietnamese military to the government's nation-building or revolutionary development program. Nearly half of the Vietnamese Army is now engaged in or in training for this vital program, which will improve the lot of the people. This is a difficult role for a military force. Vietnamese soldiers are not only defending villages and hamlets, but with spirit and energy, they have turned to the task of nation building as well.
States that were free and independent, and if you read about the discussions that take place in the Constituent Assembly, which are free and open, you find varying points of view. None of them want to see Viet Cong take over, and there's been no indication that they're ready to accept Ho Chi Minh's dictates.
The United States has exhausted almost every procedure, every idea. We've traveled all over the world. We've tried to get the assistance of the 17 neutral nations, the Secretary General of the UN, the British Commonwealth, the President of India, the President of Ghana. We've made unilateral declarations about unconditional discussions. We've had private contacts with Hanoi. In other words, what we've been saying is, why don't you come to the table and let's see if there's a basis for peace? Well, now, when they say that, no, not unless you recognize the Liberation Front as the sole spokesman for the South Vietnamese people, we can't do that. That's what the shooting is all about.
This report examines the war in Vietnam. It deals with the questions, what are the chances of negotiation and peace? Is there something new in the situation today compared to a year ago? On Friday, March 3, 1967, Senator Robert Kennedy gives his views about the conditions today compared to a year ago.
This is the first time they have stated publicly that they're willing to come to the negotiating table, and under what circumstances they were willing to come to the negotiating table, which were possible for us to accept. And these are possible for us to accept. They don't have the preconditions that they had a year ago. All I'm suggesting, therefore, is we do the same thing that we were willing to do a year ago.
Senator Kennedy said, they, North Vietnam, Hanoi, don't have the preconditions that they had a year ago. What did he mean by this statement? A year ago, Hanoi's terms for peace demanded that the United States recognize the National Liberation Front as the sole genuine representative of the South Vietnamese people. Of course, the United States could not accept such a one-sided condition. The following is what Secretary of State Dean Rusk said, appearing before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, February 18, 1966.
The United States has exhausted almost every procedure, every idea. We've traveled all over the world. We've tried to get the assistance of the 17 neutral nations, the Secretary General of the UN, the British Commonwealth, the President of India, the President of Ghana. We've made unilateral declarations about unconditional discussions. We've had private contacts with Hanoi. In other words, what we've been saying is, why don't you come to the table and let's see if there's a basis for peace? Now, when they say that, no, not unless you recognize the Liberation Front as the sole spokesman for the South Vietnamese people, we can't do that. That's what the shooting is all about. There can be elections in which the South Vietnamese people can make their own decisions about these matters. But the Liberation Front, or at least Ho Chi Minh, in his message to heads of government, in particular to President Radhakrishnan recently, says that if we really want a peaceful settlement, we must accept the four-point stand of the North Vietnamese government and prove this by actual deeds. We must end unconditionally and for good all bombing raids and other war acts against the DRV, with no reference whatever to any of the acts of war that they are committing, and that we must recognize the Liberation Front as the sole genuine representative of the people of South Vietnam and engage in negotiations with it.
As you have heard, a year ago, Hanoi demanded that the United States recognize the National Liberation Front, the political arm of the Viet Cong, as the sole genuine representative of all the South Vietnamese people. What about today? Has Hanoi changed its terms for peace? Today, Ho Chi Minh has publicly compromised his terms for peace regarding the National Liberation Front. In a letter to Pope Paul, he demands that the National Liberation Front, the political arm of the Viet Cong, simply be recognized, and says nothing about its being recognized as the sole genuine representative of all the South Vietnamese people. President Johnson reviewed North Vietnam's terms for peace March 15, 1967. Please distinguish between Hanoi's military and political demands.
Their response, as you know, delivered to His Holiness the Pope, was this: the United States must put an end to their aggression in Vietnam, end unconditionally and definitively the bombing and all other acts of war against the Democratic Republic of Vietnam, withdraw from South Vietnam all American and satellite troops, recognize the South Vietnamese National Front for Liberation, and let the Vietnamese people settle themselves their own affairs, unquote. So that is where we stand today.
That is where we stand today. With regard to political objectives, today Ho Chi Minh is no longer demanding that the National Liberation Front be recognized as the sole genuine representative of all the South Vietnamese people. Instead, Ho Chi Minh is asking that their side only be recognized, not solely be recognized. That is why Senator Robert Kennedy, on March 3, 1967, said,
"This is the first time they have stated publicly that they're willing to come to the negotiating table. And under what circumstances they were willing to come to the negotiating table, which were possible for us to accept, and these are possible for us to accept. They don't have the precondition that they had a year ago.
Because Hanoi does not have the preconditions that it had a year ago, Senator Robert Kennedy, on March 2, 1967, made a Senate speech in which he outlined a three-point program which he believes might bring Hanoi to peace negotiations. Senator Kennedy's most recent peace effort does not just involve ending the bombing of North Vietnam. Most important, it involves a willingness to begin negotiations based upon America's stated limited political objective and Hanoi's newest limited political objective, both of which would permit all the people of South Vietnam the freedom to determine their own future and form their own kind of government through genuinely free elections, in which all political elements within South Vietnam, including the National Liberation Front, would be free to participate. Senator Kennedy was asked this question.
What makes you think that the North Vietnamese would react favorably to your proposal? They said they want a permanent end to the bombing.
Now, Mr. Ho Chi Minh did not say that. He did not say that. I've said in my speech yesterday that there are on Thursday that there have been conflicting reports, but there have been important and significant figures who have just talked about the ending of the bombing and have not used the word permanent. During the Cuban Missile Crisis, conflicting reports came in from Mr. Khrushchev just before they withdrew the missiles from Cuba on Sunday. One report came in on Friday night, an entirely different report with conditions that in a letter to President Kennedy came in on Saturday night. President Kennedy accepted the offer of Friday night, and the result was that Mr. Khrushchev and the Russians withdrew the missiles from Cuba. I suggest the same thing now. We suggest we accept that offer from the communists, which is in our own best interest, the offer that has been made public. We move on that, then it's up to them. All I'm suggesting, therefore, is we do the same thing that we were willing to do a year ago.
What were we willing to do a year ago? A year ago, the United States stopped the bombing of North Vietnam for 37 days, hoping our restraint might bring negotiations. Now we will not stop the bombing. Even though North Vietnam has made the following peace proposal, which Premier Kosygin of Russia defined and supported at his London Foreign Press Conference, February 9, 1967. For these reasons, Senator Robert Kennedy suggested that America stop the bombing, go to the negotiating table, and see if we could find a negotiated political settlement.
This is the first time they have stated publicly that they're willing to come to the negotiating table, and under what circumstances they were willing to come to the negotiating table, which were possible for us to accept, and these are possible for us to accept. They don't have the precondition that they had a year ago. All I'm suggesting, therefore, is we do the same thing that we were willing to do a year ago. That's why I've suggested we stop the bombing, go to the negotiating table, and see if we can find a negotiated settlement. If we cannot, and it's very possible that we cannot, at least we will have known, our own people will have known, our soldiers will have known, and the world will have known that the United States did all in its power to find a peaceful solution to this terrible war in Vietnam.
The American people are free to do what they want to do. That's the essence of democracy. And I'm sure that all of us in the government would feel very strongly about the right of people to engage in the democratic process. That's what Vietnam is all about. What we're saying in Vietnam is that the essence of our position is that we want the people of South Vietnam to make their own decision about their own destiny in a democratic way. And we don't want the decision to be imposed upon them by force.
The president's proposal asked Hanoi virtually to abandon its forces in the South before the United States would end the bombing of the North. To ask Hanoi to end the resupply and reinforcement of its forces in the South was unrealistic. And an affirmative response to that request was absolutely impossible under existing circumstances.
President Johnson today appealed to the railroads.
With American forces taking over much of the burden of combat, the Army of the Republic of South Vietnam has been given the specific assignment of pacifying the villages and gaining the support of the peasants. Tonight, from CBS News correspondent Morley Safer, we have a special report on that army.
This is the biggest boot camp in Vietnam, the Lam Son Training Center. And every month, thousands of men come through this place. Most of them are like these men, conscripts, unsuccessful draft dodgers who were rounded up by the police. This is the basic raw material for ARVN, the Army of the Republic of Vietnam. Life in the Army of Vietnam is a catalog of mismanagement, bad leadership, harsh discipline, no discipline, and medieval living conditions. It is little wonder that the motivation of an ARVN trooper is open to question. Some examples. The reason these men are working in their underwear is simply that they have been issued with one set of fatigues, which they've been ordered to keep clean. On paper, he is in for 4 years. In fact, he is in for life, unless he can afford the price of a bribe to buy his way out. If a man breaks the rules, and the rules are very vague indeed, he is imprisoned in this, a 3-foot-high barbed wire cage. A request for a discharge after serving the so-called compulsory 4 years in the Army means an automatic 15 days in the cage. On one point, there is general agreement that the Vietnamese soldier is as good as anyone if he is properly led. The senior American advisor at Lam Son is Lieutenant Colonel Alva Hollingsworth of Albuquerque.
This leadership problem is one that's common to all armies, I think. Other than that, he's a very fine soldier.
What is the problem in leadership? Why can't they get better officers?
Well, you see, they are fighting a war at the same time that they're trying to train and increase their army. So it's just a leadership problem because of attrition. Lost in combat, it's hard to replace them and increase their numbers in platoon leaders and company commanders.
113,000 Vietnamese troopers deserted last year. The figure for 1966 is running about 20% higher. When U.S. advisors are assigned to ARVN units, they're at once amazed and dismayed by what they see. Sergeant Luther Shepherd of New York City advises ARVN GIs.
Some of the problems that we find is that the man lacks stamina that the American soldier has, but this is caused because of lack of proper food. They also do not have the facilities that the American soldier has, such as showers, clean places to sleep, adequate barracks facilities. I think all of these tend to cause the man to lack motivation when he's in the training center.
Food is the most frequent gripe. The Ministry of Defense allots the Army 20 cents a day per man. That is supposed to cover 3 meals.
The food that you see now on the table, sir, is the dinner meal, which is a big meal here at Lam Son, and it is prepared. What you have on the table is for 8 soldiers.
What do they get? Would you tell us what the ingredients are?
Sir, in the center pan, they have rice, and this rice, they usually have all the rice that they want to eat. In the pan here, they have rau muong, which is a vegetable similar to our spinach. It's made of a soup. And each man has one fish.
And that's nook mom, of course.
Nook mom, yes, sir. The sauce you see them dipping out with hot peppers.
Is that, in your opinion, enough to keep a GI going in combat situations?
Not the American GI, sir, I don't believe. I think that these people would use a little more, too.
Going on a Vietnamese operation is very often like going on a picnic. The troops are noisy and friendly. They laugh at the kind of physical adversity that the Mekong Delta offers. For many, it also offers the first square meal in weeks. The first victims of most ARVN operations are the village chickens.
The troops come in, disrupt local life, steal the chickens and pigs, and take the rice. Can you change that kind of attitude?
Well, I think that it can be changed. We need to improve their field rations, which we're working on. We need to improve their diet. I don't believe that in this particular area right here, they get a high enough protein diet. And it's just a simple fact that if a man's hungry, he might steal a little bit. It's gone on in other armies besides this one, so I don't think that it's anything unusual, and maybe they've been over-criticized for it.
This is the biggest concern of American officials involved in retraining the Vietnamese Army for pacification. The fear that all the ground gained by military operations could be lost by the thoughtless action of government troops sent in to convince the peasants of the government's interest in their welfare. The real question is, can an army that doesn't believe in itself pass on a sense of national stability to the people? Morty Safer, CBS News, with the Army of the Republic of Vietnam.
On Sunday, April 23rd, Henry Cabot Lodge said, before leaving South Vietnam,
I grant you that the pacification can't work until the people believe in it. The people believe in pacification, and then it begins to work. And of course, people don't believe in the thing if they're being maltreated and insulted and so on. But I think we've hit bottom on that, and it's getting steadily better.
That the major problem confronting us, and you gentlemen likewise have seen this, is in the area of what we call the revolutionary rural development or the pacification program. What is wrong, it seems to me, is that the civilian components that are responsible for pacification have not been able to really fulfill the requirements of that task. Of course, you require, first of all, you must have security before your civilian officers or your civilian forces can really do the job as you expect them to do. The cadres that have been trained, that is the South Vietnamese that are being trained to move in, these teams of 59 that move into a village and into an area, they have been coming along, but the training was not as good as it should have been, and it has had to be improved. I can say that the pacification program has not worked as well as we had hoped it would, on the basis of our goals at the Honolulu Conference. I can also say that we're going to redouble our efforts, not only we, but one of the things that undoubtedly will be discussed at the Manila Conference is this whole matter of the social economic conditions in South Vietnam, the rural development, the pacification, the post-war plans for South Vietnam.
You know, what about the great pacification effort that's been made? How successful is that deemed to be?
So far, hardly at all. The pacification effort, I assume you mean the effort to seize more and more territory from the Viet Cong,
hold it, and
develop a sound social structure
right
within the villages that is responsive to the government in Saigon. We have had, you know, a half a dozen plans in a half a dozen years, and Diem government had it, and now the Key government. Largely, the failure has been twofold. One is more or less military. That is, there have still not been enough troops available to spread them out so thinly as to be able to hold territory very long. Troops sweep in there, but they have to move on to other duties, and unless they were to sit there for months at a time, essentially doing nothing and therefore being militarily wasted, they could not perform this essentially political function. So the villagers have not had enough sense of security. They're not going to stick their necks out and cooperate with the government or indeed with the Viet Cong. They just wish everybody else would go away because they don't know from week to week who's going to be overrunning the village next. Another reason is that the war and the whole experience in Vietnam the last decade has really wiped out what leadership and what social structure there was in the villages, and it's very hard to replace these arbitrarily. You can't just pull a young fellow off a farm and say you're the new village chief after the Viet Cong has killed the old one, or after the old one has been drafted or has given up in disgust or whatnot. So you don't have the manpower from the outside to secure the areas, you don't really have the manpower on the inside, and then you weave into that all kinds of real economic problems, inflation, the crop failures that have developed in certain areas. That's less of a problem. The the land reform is the crucial one that no progress has been made on. So the whole thing is not going anywhere.
They may be defeated at their own game. Well, CBS News correspondent Mike Wallace put those questions to a much decorated American officer who came to know the guerrillas' methods in his job as chief of an area pacification program.
This war has developed few public heroes. Lieutenant Colonel Robert Schweitzer of Chicago is one of them. Wounded 8 times, decorated 11 times, including 3 Silver Stars. He was wounded again the other night. He picked up a hand grenade thrown at his men by the VC to throw it back. The grenade shattered his arm, his stomach, damaged his vocal cords. Colonel Schweitzer, why is it that the Viet Cong fight so hard? They're taking huge losses, and they come back as hard as ever.
Mike, it's a matter of motivation. This has been the great thing that the Viet Cong cadres and teams have had going for them. They work in groups of 3 each day to instill in their people motivation, discipline, and a sense of a cause. Now, we're doing this too. I say we are speaking this joint Vietnamese-American effort. And this concept of dedication to bringing about a revolution is what you see taking place in Vietnam now.
Well, in a sense, you're saying then that the Viet Cong understood the need for a revolution ahead of the GVN, ahead of the government of Vietnam. And the government of Vietnam really is now trying to steal the Viet Cong's thunder because it was worth stealing.
I think for a long time that we were always one whole phase behind the VC. We were one program behind them. We were always reacting to something they had started 6 months earlier, and quite frequently during those early years, our programs would be out of time because they'd be on, at that point, into a new program. But this time, we've got the initiative.
And how are you able to get rid of the VC in the villages, day and night?
The basic technique is the cordon and search operation. This is followed by area saturation patrolling 7 days a week, 24 hours a day. And you have to keep it up and up and up. And this is what we're doing with both U.S. and Vietnamese forces.
And you're satisfied it's working?
It is, Mike. There's no question about it.
Just in your area or throughout the country?
I believe this is happening throughout Vietnam. I'm sure it's happening in my area.
May 8, 1967.
During the past year and a half, we have sought out the enemy, caught him off guard, fought him before he was ready. For a time, he stood and fought, and we punished him severely. Now he is becoming more difficult to find. We have invaded his elaborate and widely scattered base areas, some of them built over a period of 20 years. Working closely with the Vietnamese forces, we have moved into many of the populated and productive areas which formerly provided supplies and recruits to the enemy. We have turned the enemy's ambushes against them, and we have learned how to draw him into an ambush. We have sent out deep patrols to find him. He has been punished by B-52 strikes and unparalleled close support from our tactical air, artillery, and naval gunfire. On land and sea, we have made his infiltration costly. Although the military picture is favorable, I emphasize the fact that we have no evidence to indicate that the enemy is slowing his invasion from the north, or that he is breaking up his major units and scattering them about, or that he is giving up his plans to try to inflict major defeat upon us. He is taking great casualties, and he does have logistic problems. but his leadership is good, and his men are tough and tenacious. He needs a victory for political, psychological, and morale purposes, and he will continue to strive for one. So the end is not in sight. The enemy can hide in the jungles and mountains of South Vietnam, where we cannot reach him without major effort. He rests and regroups, trains and replenishes in hidden camps and supply areas in regions along the borders of neutral countries and the demilitarized zone, which he overtly violated almost a year ago. He continues to recruit and train guerrillas for use as guides and intelligence agents for his main force units and for sabotage and terror. So we must be prepared for bitter fighting in the days to come.
After his speech, General Westmoreland was asked,
"The Viet Cong are generally regarded to have fought well against rough odds for some time. To what do you attribute their spirit?" The Viet Cong organized, directed, and commanded from Hanoi have placed great emphasis on political indoctrination. As a matter of interest, their training program for their units devotes more time to political indoctrination than it does to military training. This indoctrination is well done and skillful. And of course, it's backed up by a ruthless cadre that use strong arm methods if required to keep their troops in line. Now, their so-called cadre or leadership are excellent. They have been well trained and indoctrinated, and they're committed.
The following Friday, April 28, 1967, General Westmoreland spoke before a joint session of Congress. Again, he mentioned enemy strength.
"During the last 22 months, the number of enemy combat battalions in the South has increased significantly, and nearly half of them are now North Vietnamese. In the same period, overall enemy strength has nearly doubled in spite of large combat losses. Enemy commanders are skilled professionals. In general, their troops are indoctrinated, well-trained, aggressive, and under tight control. The enemy's logistic system is primitive in many ways. Forced to transport most of his supplies down through southeastern Laos, he uses a combination of trucks, bicycles, men, and animals. But he does this with surprising effectiveness. In South Vietnam, the system is also well organized. Many of the caches we have found and destroyed have been stocked with enough supplies and equipment to support months of future operations. The enemy emphasizes what he calls strategic mobility, although his tactics are based on foot mobility, relatively modest firepower, and often primitive means of communication. However, his operational planning is meticulous. He gathers intelligence, makes careful plans, assigns specific objectives in detail, and then rehearses the plan of attack until he believes it cannot fail. In 3 years of close study and daily observation, I have seen no evidence that this is an internal insurrection. I have seen much evidence to the contrary, documented by the enemy himself, that it is aggression from the North. Since 1954, when the Geneva Accords were signed, the North Vietnamese have been sending leaders
political organizers, technicians, and experts on terrorism and sabotage into the South. Clandestinely directed from the North, they and their Hanoi-trained Southern counterparts have controlled the entire course of attack against the Republic of South Vietnam. What kind of war is being fought in Vietnam? What we have is not a civil war. It is a massive campaign of external aggression from North Vietnam.
It was in the I Corps area, three different provinces of I Corps, that the Viet Cong first took hold of South Vietnam. And they've been here for 18 years now in these various sections. And the families have known nothing else but the communist way of life for 18 years. Many of the families have heard nothing about the government life because they've been shielded from the government. They've made sure they've been isolated from the government way of life. They have been taught that Americans are here as aggressors and that we're here to take from them what they have, what little they do have. And this is one of our real big problems, to convince them that we're here to help them.
Perhaps no concern on the other side to stop. Yeah. Well, I think that's a very fair and important question. And I think my response would be like this. We have made, I think, three pauses, one of 4 days, one of 5 days, and then one of 37 days. I don't have anything myself that a 4- and 5-day pause was long enough to build up any kind of credibility. And I do not think, and I did not think then, that even the 37-day pause was really enough to be persuasive to the other side. Because we have been engaged in bombing for well over a year. I mean, the relentless day-by-day bombing, then there is a brief pause. And trying to put myself in the shoes of the other people as well as ourselves, that was not a long enough time, I think, to really gain for us this kind of credibility. That's simply a judgment that one makes. Obviously, those in Washington felt that it was plenty long enough.
May 21st, 1967.
Now, you said when we were talking about the Korean War that General MacArthur had taken the firm position the Chinese would never enter that war. They did enter the war. We again today are having a similar controversy. It's very much like the Korean, with some people saying, look out, the Chinese may come in. Others saying, oh, it never, they won't come in. Are we in danger of repeating the mistake that General MacArthur made?
Well, I don't think as long as we have President Johnson as president, he'll repeat the mistakes. I think he thoroughly understands the risks involved. If you went at the North recklessly and invaded the North, I think it's quite plain that they would. But they might very well come in if we were to attack the North, as attack China as they want to attack it. But North Vietnam does not want to bring the Chinese in. They want to be independent of China. And if we were to attempt to block them out or take the North over, which the president has no intention of doing, or changing the government in North Vietnam, they would come in.
Governor, at the time of the Korean War, there was a great deal of controversy in the government over the decision to march to the Yalu. I remember that General Bradley, for example, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff at that time, was strongly of the opinion that we should halt somewhere along the parallel or at one time at what they called the narrow waist.
That's right.
There was a decision, however, to strike for the Yalu, and we were thrown back. What was your position on that issue?
Well,
at the time?
That wasn't quite that way. There was never any decision, as far as the government is concerned, as I recall it. I think it would be very hard to have stopped the United Nations forces from moving back and attempting to destroy the armies of North Korea. It was a very strong opinion. The British had it. We should hold at the Narrows. And it was General MacArthur that moved ahead. The Joint Chiefs of Staff sent him telegrams saying, are you sure that you're not getting extended? And I don't think they fully knew that General MacArthur had divided his two armies, one to the east and one to the west, and it was through the center that the Chinese poured. didn't realize how exposed they were because it all happened so fast. But I remember very clearly being gravely concerned by the fact that the Marine Division went up into the reservoir number and the 7th Division moved up to the Yalu in the north. And I was gravely concerned because General MacArthur felt convinced the Chinese would not intervene. I was at Wake Island, remember, at that discussion. And I remember General MacArthur saying, "Mr. President, I know the Chinese well. I can assure you that they will never intervene." Well, his intelligence did not conform with that of Washington, and Washington kept warning him. But we have a system of giving the field commander a great deal of discretion. And this was not a decision. There was a lot of difference of opinion. But I know that I was gravely concerned by this, by the attempt to move into the mountains.
May 21st, 1967.
You said, whether or not history is bunk, the American picture of current history is bunk unquestionably. Have you had any reason in the past 2 years to change that view?
On the whole, I think the American view hasn't much changed. What I meant, of course, was that the Americans were acting as though there were a thing called monolithic world communism. And there isn't such a thing now, and it's become more obvious in the course of time. Americans are rather reluctant to change their picture of the world, I'm afraid.
In what ways are the Americans wrong about this idea of monolithic world communism?
Well, I think that the chief religion in the world today is nationalism, not either communism or capitalism. And whenever there's a clash between nationalism and one of the other ideologies, nationalism always wins. This was the issue between Stalin and Trotsky. Trotsky wanted to expand Russia to spread the communist revolution. He was a monolithic world communist. Stalin wanted to use communism for Russia's advantage. Now, Stalin won, and this was not accidental, I think. So I think nationalism comes first. And unless you look at people as being nationalists first and communists or capitalists only incidentally, you would get the facts wrong, I think.
Professor Toynbee, we're very much, of course, concerned today with the war in Vietnam.
Yes.
How is our distorted image of current history affected by our posture in Vietnam?
Well, I think your posture in Vietnam is very much affected by your distorted view of history.
Mm-hmm.
I think if you would look at the history of Vietnam, you would see that for 2,000 years, the Vietnamese have been successfully resisting being absorbed by China. There have been masses of small peoples like that who, in the course of centuries, have been turned into Chinese. And the Vietnamese, being tough, have resisted that. Now, you're really creating the myth that you've invented. You're making it into reality by forcing Vietnam into the arms of China, which is just where she doesn't really want to go, I think.
May 4th, 1967.
Our guest today was Henry Steele Commager, professor at Amherst College and one of the most distinguished and popular of American historians.
Our own view of expansion and aggression is a distorted one. Most of us have been deeply disturbed over the prospect of Soviet expansion. And we are disturbed now at the prospect of Chinese aggression and expansion. And some protagonists of our war in Vietnam defend it chiefly on the ground that it is designed to put a halt to Chinese aggression. It might be good for us to remember that in the eyes of the 19th century world, it was the United States that was preeminently the expansionist and aggressive nation. In the first half of the century, this new nation, with, be it remembered, an ideology as pernicious in the eyes of legitimate governments as communism is in our eyes, this new nation expanded from the Mississippi to the Pacific. We bought Louisiana, we forced Spain out of the West, out of West Florida, and maneuvered her out of East Florida. We annexed Texas and fought a war with Mexico, which ended by stripping her of half of her territory, the Southwest and California. We ousted the British from the Pacific Northwest. Thus, in half a century, we trebled our territory at the expense of France, Spain, Mexico, and Britain. In the same period, our presidents announced the Monroe Doctrine and the Polk Doctrine, proclaiming, in effect, American hegemony throughout the Western Hemisphere. If China today should put on a show of this kind, we might truly be alarmed. Other examples of our double standard come readily to mind. We maintain powerful military installations in a great arc around eastern China, from Japan, Okinawa, the Philippines, Taiwan, Guam, to Vietnam and Thailand. If this requires some stretch of the imagination, if China should somehow set up powerful military installations in British Columbia, Mexico, Cuba, Bermuda, and Newfoundland, we might not think very well of it. We claim in all sincerity a vital interest in Vietnam, though we did not tolerate a Soviet claim to a vital interest in Cuba. Nor, for that matter, do we accept the claim of China to a vital interest in Vietnam, which is rather closer to Peking than Saigon is to Washington. We have long asserted a sphere of influence in the Caribbean, and even managed to get that sphere formally accepted, recognized, in the League of Nations and the United Nations charters. But we are not prepared to concede to China a comparable sphere of influence in Southeast Asia. We think ourselves justified in intervening in the domestic affairs of Guatemala and Santo Domingo, but we would be very surprised if Cuba intervened in Florida to put down guerrilla organizations, or Mexico in the affairs of Texas. We look with alarm on the spread of nuclear weapons, as indeed we must, and President Johnson asserted that it was a dark day when China detonated a nuclear bomb. We appear to forget that so far we are the only nation that has ever used a nuclear bomb in anger, though it must not be supposed the Japanese have wholly forgotten this. What I am suggesting is that we need to cultivate patience, tolerance, the long view, and even sympathy with the new nations of the globe, even if their emergence onto the crowded stage of history is turbulent and dangerous. We would do well to recover something of Jefferson's perspective on the French Revolution, which horrified almost all Western peoples, just as communism does today. It was, he said, the agonizing spasms of infuriated man seeking through blood and slaughter his long-lost liberties. Long-lost liberties is, to be sure, not the phrase we instinctively apply to either the Russian or the Chinese revolutions. For alas, they did not have liberties. They did not enjoy them in their historical past. But that they are seeking to throw off what they assume to be tyranny and exploitation. In the case of the Soviet, a homegrown brand of tyranny. In the case of China, foreign exploitation. And achieve independence and progress in their own way is beyond dispute. What is sobering and even paradoxical is that the new or the old new nations, such as China and India, of the globe are trying to carry through their revolution with the tools which we have fashioned. The dynamic instrument is revolution, the political instrument is nationalism, the social instrument is equality, the economic instrument is science and technology. All of these are Western inventions. We must inescapably bear much of the responsibility for what is going on in the underdeveloped nations of the world, even in nations like China. And we should, I think, be prepared to acknowledge that responsibility. For if we did not precisely invent any of the instruments which these new nations are now using, we did illustrate their potentialities more fully and on the whole more happily, more successfully than any other nation. The United States was the first nation to be founded squarely on the right of revolution, that is, the right to alter or abolish government and institute new government. Let us have patience with revolution and even with alien ideologies. We had our revolution. We created our nation. We formulated our ideology of democracy and equality. We had our expansion, our territorial conquest, and our manifest destiny. We established our spheres of influence and our hegemonies, and we did all these things without serious interference from the old established nations.
February 20th, 1967.
I know of no immediate undertakings by the Soviet Union or by any of the Eastern European communist states to extend their territory in any direction, any serious ones that we would have to be worried about. And what you have left, really, is Cuba and communist China. Now, the communist Chinese have been guilty of what seemed to me to be at least very sharp actions in the case of Tibet and of the Indian border. Those were both areas in which they could at least claim a traditional Chinese interest and could link this to some extent to the traditional aims and area of sovereignty of China. They also, of course, intervened in the Korean War, and I wouldn't mean to condone that intervention. On the other hand, I must point out that it did not happen until we approached their borders, about which they are very sensitive. Otherwise, I'm not aware that they have used their own forces for purposes of aggression anywhere else. Now, whether their ideology or an ideology calling itself communist comes to be the ideology of the governing group in a neighboring country is another question, and a very, very difficult one for us. It always has been, and we have found varying answers to it. In some cases, we have opposed it by force of arms, and others we have not. I don't think you can make any rule about this. And before we make decisions on what we have to do about the behavior of this or that communist regime, I think we ought to wait and see the whites of their eyes and make sure exactly how this relates to our security.
January 30th, 1967.
The heart of the matter is, again, the phenomenon of aggression. And if the momentum of aggression should begin to roll in that part of the world, stimulated or supported or engaged in by those who are committed to the spread of the world revolution by violence, then that seems to put us back on the trail that led us into World War II. What is important is that all nations, large and small, have a chance to live unmolested by their neighbors, as provided in the United Nations Charter. Article 1 of the Charter deals with acts of aggression, breaches of the peace, the necessity for a peaceful settlement of disputes. Article 2 of the Charter talks about the self-determination of peoples. These are very important lessons derived from the events which led us into World War II. We feel that we've got to hang on to those lessons because if they lead us into World War III, there won't be much left from which we can draw lessons and start over again.
Mr. Secretary, is it not the question so much of our vital interests as of a threat to our vital interests? Now, you said yesterday that four presidents have identified this area as being strategically important to us. At the time that process started, we're talking about President Truman now and in President Eisenhower's time, there certainly did seem to be a major threat to our interests in that area. What has happened to the nature of that threat? During the last year, I have in mind the breach between Moscow and Peking. Is there not a diminution in the threat to our interests in that area because Moscow and Peking are no longer close together?
Well, Peking has the capability of maintaining a major threat in the area, depending upon both its policy and its action. You see, we have a very strong interest in the organization of peace in the Pacific, just as we have in the Atlantic. We have alliances with Korea and Japan and the Republic of China and the Philippines, Thailand, Australia, New Zealand. So we are very much interested in the stability of the peace in the Pacific Ocean area and in East Asia. Now, if these aggressive pressures from Hanoi with the support of Peking should move into Southeast Asia, not only are hundreds of millions of people involved, vital resources involved, but the prospects for a durable peace dissolve. And so we have a tremendous interest in establishing in that area of the world, as we have done in the NATO area, the notion that the nations must be left alone and be allowed to live in peace as the Charter of the United Nations provides.
But the danger 2 years ago was much greater than it is now, surely.
Well, I'm not sure. What is going to be the reaction of the authorities in Peking when they get all of these present troubles sorted out? What are they going to do about their doctrine of militant support of the world revolution? They've had a series of setbacks in the last 2 years. A major setback in Indonesia. Catastrophe in the Afro-Asian conference. They put in an ultimatum to India during the India-Pakistan fighting and had to back away from it. They've been almost expelled from the world communist movement. They've been expelled from four or five countries in Africa. Now, these have undoubtedly put great pressures on the leadership there. And my guess is that one of the reasons why there is considerable turmoil at the top in mainland China today is that there must have been some important policy discussions there about whether or not they're on the right track.
January 12, 1967.
Are international communism and Chinese neo-imperialism growing or fading menaces? The threat of unitary world communism sweeping Asia is largely faded. And the menace of Chinese domination, if ever it was a real menace in the military sense, is growing weaker. I believe that we have tended to overestimate its strength and its immediate menace to our interests and to its neighbors. The events of recent months have helped show how backward and troubled this country really is. Its economic progress will probably continue to be very slow for the foreseeable future. Thus, our concern should be focused less on its immediate threat and more on its long-range development. In more specific terms, we should not concentrate so exclusively on the problem of containing Chinese aggressiveness, but instead should place more emphasis on finding ways to bring the Chinese into meaningful contact with us and other nations, so that they will learn more about the realities of the outside world and will thus in time come to realize that they must accommodate themselves to these realities. I applaud our efforts to find new contacts with the communist Chinese through the exchange of newsmen, scholars, and other private citizens. I look upon trade contacts with communist China as being probably of more value to the achievement of our long-range objectives than detrimental to our short-term interests. I feel that we should not oppose Peking's entry into the United Nations or other international bodies, so long as it is willing to enter on the same terms as do other countries. Such stands would mean the clear adoption of a policy towards communist China of containment without isolation. Or, as the president put it last July 12th, a policy of reconciliation. The realization that the United States was not attempting to blackball the Peking regime in the United Nations and would welcome peaceful coexistence with communist China would also help remove a serious psychological barrier that stands in the way of the improvement of relations between us. The Asian sensitivity towards advanced industrialized countries, and particularly towards the United States as the strongest of these nations, is especially marked in the case of the Chinese. China is not only the largest country in the world, for many centuries it was the most advanced, and the Chinese are certainly, and not entirely without reason, the proudest people in the world. But they have been subjected to a century and more of national humiliation at the hands of technologically superior powers. We must be especially careful to understand this historic legacy under which the Chinese labor in their relations with the outside world. It is not surprising that the communist Chinese fiercely resent the implication in our present policy that we have the right to pass judgment on the nature of their government and that we feel it is either unable or else unfit to continue to rule over the country that it clearly controls. The removal of these implications in our policy seems to me to be an important first step we must take if we are ever to build a more satisfactory relationship with continental China. I might add that such a relationship is a prerequisite to a truly peaceful future for the whole of Asia. Regarding the strength of China, let's say 20 years from now, you spoke of the great resources as well as the great population, in a sense, though, they negate each other. In a sense, they negate each other. The very fact that they have these 700 million people or 800 million people to feed, and that they're still growing at a very rapid rate, means that they keep consuming what resources they have just to keep going. Even today, the Japanese with 100 million people are probably producing more wealth than these 700 or 800 million Chinese, but only feeding 100 million people, they have a lot more left over to do something with. They're 8% growth per year in real terms, economically, and 1% in population leaves what? A 7% growth over population per year. The Chinese may be doing well if they're growing 1% over population per year. They're not going to produce a great deal of extra beyond just living costs to put into national power that, what, build up a great war machine or something of this sort. But it's very hard for me to see in a 20-year period, or even a much longer period, a kind of military strength, modern military strength, developing there. There would be really any essential challenge to the Soviet Union, let alone ourselves. I should assume we will maintain our great naval power in that part of the world and our capacities to bring military power very easily to that part of the world. I also see the countries around China probably growing a little faster in this growth of economy over population than China is. Most of them are doing that. Of course, the Japanese quite spectacularly, but even the ones of Southeast Asia. They're certainly firming up as national units, as going concerns. And one of the great forces in that part of the world is fear, and let's say maybe even hatred of the Chinese. There's a great wall of resentment and opposition to Chinese domination built up by Asian nationalism, and this is getting stronger all the time.
No.
Vietnam has this long history of antipathy for China and fear of Chinese domination. That is the biggest theme in their whole history. I cannot imagine even a communist regime in Vietnam not sort of casting themselves in the role of being absolutely independent of the Chinese.
You make reference to the Cold War demonology. Would you tell us just what you mean by that?
Oh, I don't know. That's a color word, and I shouldn't have used it, probably. That means a sort of, you know, interpreting everything in terms of a great communist conspiracy and in terms of communists being supermen that somehow can overcome these great problems of differences between national units and so on. They aren't supermen at all. Their feet of clay extend almost all the way up to their brains. They do very badly. And I don't, they would no more be able to make a unified communist Asia than, well, we could make a unified world under our control. And much less could they do it, because they don't have the power. They're running against the tides of nationalism throughout Asia. That's what I meant. But what I was trying to point out, that communist regimes aren't likely to develop in less developed countries in any case. There's a strong nationalist bar against it. It was going to be much more effective than what we can do in a military way. Even if some were to be successful, in the long run, it probably would not be dangerous to us. They are not going to be successful as communist regimes. It's a long history. By the time that country is important, it probably will have evolved into something quite different. And this would not have cast its pattern for all time, as some people seem to think. The cards, I think, are much more stacked on our side than they are on the side of communism.
January 31st, 1967.
In 1954, when the French left Vietnam, I think one broad figure that is significant is that about 40% of the land planted in rice in South, what we call today South Vietnam, was owned by about 2,500 people, and that rents took 50% or more of the tenants' product. Now, that was throughout the whole of South Vietnam, with the majority of this being in the southern part.
So how many holders of land did you say?
2,500 people, roughly, owned about 40% of the land that was planted in rice.
Mm-hmm.
And there were approximately 1,200,000 tenants mm-hmm. at that time.
So that's a lot of people.
This was in 1954.
Yeah. Are there some people in agriculture who are not tenants, but they're working their own land. Is that a considerable
Well, large portion? Numbers of people, yes.
Yes, oh yeah. Yeah.
This is a larger number than this 1.25 million, you see.
Yeah.
If we got a population in South Vietnam of around, let's say, we counted them a few years back at 12 million, there's been an expansion, 14 or 15. Remember, we never have really taken a census. The Vietnamese were getting up to it, but never actually did it. So that, and if you got 75% of those living on the land to a certain extent, well, you got yourself 8 or 9 million people here.
Total.
Total, and if you got 1.25 million of these who are tenants, you got yourself 5 or 6 million or 7 million people who are sort of own their land and operate it on their own.
Small plots, presumably.
That's right, but, and much smaller in central Vietnam than in southern Vietnam.
How about the city or the urban land holdings? We're talking about who owns Vietnam. Are they, take a city like Saigon. Saigon, I think, has, 2 million? Saigon
we don't
area.
Know today. It's been so flooded with refugees, but it's a huge city. Let me just start by saying that of the portion of land in the major cities that is privately owned, I think one may presume that a fair proportion of it is owned by Chinese, which constitutes another aspect
Are they living
of a socioeconomic
there?
Problem. Yes, in most cases.
Yeah.
That is, the tenants come. You've got to think of this, it seems to me, in the broad terms of the rural-urban gap, which is a tremendous problem for the developing world, and one that we haven't begun to help solve in the most
I think you have an illustration of that in Cambodia, where something more than probably 95% of the peasants own their own tiny properties, but the Chinese own the peasants.
Yes.
The Chinese
yes.
are not allowed to foreclose on the land because they're not allowed to own land, but they never bother to and they never want to. They
right.
prefer to own the peasants with agricultural credit.
Credit,
yeah.
Any kind of rural reform program to be meaningful has to go beyond just redistribution of land. It seems to me so critical to understand that in this kind of setting, education, agrarian credit, cooperative marketing projects, farm-to-market roads, this whole complex has to interact, because a sheer redistribution of land without these other factors, I think everybody would agree, is not an answer. And you can make a peasant very miserable by giving him land if he doesn't have agrarian credit, if he can't read and write, if, in other words, the setting for the reform program is not a good one.
Where there's a large place. Where are these landlords? Are they living right there in on the plantations, or are they in Saigon, or are they all Vietnamese landlords, or are there other nationalities involved?
Well, if I had cousins, I'd send them into the paddy fields to get my share. I'd stay in Saigon, and I suspect this is essentially what the landlords do. What do you think?
Well, there are other safe areas like My Tho, which is down on the Mekong River, and there are people, I'm certain, landlords living there and feeling
Paris
quite secure.
Are there such
too.
Thing as
young
foreign?
Paris too,
are there foreign, are there absentee landowners in the sense of, wasn't a large part of this, were there French landowners?
Well, typical, if there's such a thing as a typical big Vietnamese landowner, he would not train his son in agriculture, but he would train his son as a doctor or as a lawyer. And he might find himself being employed as a lawyer or a doctor in Paris.
But getting the rent?
Yes. But getting no rent now.
No.
But
not
having
now,
a claim to ownership of some of this land.
But prior to 54, he would have been getting.
And of course, prior to 54, in many cases, he would also have been hoping that his son would go into government service. And the interrelationship, as you know, historically, between the landed class and the Mandarin official is an intimate one, and in many cases, of course, even at present, the political conservatives come from that class. But as Dean Lindholm was pointing out earlier, a good deal of the land in the cities has had government connections and is publicly owned, and I think he might expand on that a bit.
Well, looking at the metropolitan area, a typical Vietnamese city will have a public marketplace, which is a sort of the center where business takes place, and this will be owned by the municipality. And the municipality will get a considerable portion of its revenues by the rent they charge for people to do business in this central marketplace. Now, this is we have just a little bit of this in the United States, but in the Orient, it's highly developed. In addition to that, we have the wharfs of Saigon, are public wharfs owned by the government, and therefore they can exact rents for the various people who use them. Of course, in Saigon, there are many public buildings that are, therefore, they're government-owned. Also, it's a tradition in Vietnam and also a large portion of the Orient that the large businesses and the government provide a place for people to live, where you pay rent. One of the advantages you get from your job is a place to live. And so the government finds itself an owner of residences, apartments for their workers. So I remember when we tried to identify the land in Vietnam that was in Saigon that was privately owned that could be used as a base of the property tax, there were large sections that weren't available because they were under government control in one way or another, religious organizations and so forth.
Hmm. How about you who have been to Vietnam and to Saigon? Are there office buildings in Saigon just like there are here in San Francisco? I mean, are there?
Well, not like there are in San Francisco.
Not quite like, okay. But there are, yeah.
But of course,
what would
there,
be the biggest office
there are office buildings. Yeah. I can't recall any building going over six stories or so. There's been a certain amount of expansion, of course, in the last few years with the tremendous influx of American and other allied services. But this is not a period when you can talk about the cities of Vietnam as being comfortable or housing conditions being anywhere near adequate. This is a problem of great pressures. And I would just say that there's no question also that some individuals in Vietnam who own private property are doing exceedingly well by renting them to allied and particularly American authorities. This is one of those aspects of war and the present situation that you can imagine is making millionaires out of some people.
Dr. Lindholm, last night I heard your lecture and in which you articulated a program for the post-hostilities in Vietnam, pretty concrete program. I was wondering if you'd like to outline it shortly.
Well, I would say that
each man has a right to his program and what we should do after hostilities. Right. I don't think that at the moment I would say other than the fact that we the Oriental peasant agriculture cannot feed the people. It must become modern agriculture. The numbers of people living on the land must be decreased. The numbers of people living in a relative industrial type of society in the cities must be increased. Now to bring this about within a democratic framework is become it is a very, very difficult thing to accomplish. And the communists have a difficult time accomplishing it too, as indicated by what's happened in Russia and China and places where they have had power. I indicated that it's education that's so terrifically important. And also that maybe a real contribution could be made by land tax, particularly in the cities, as a start to begin to provide some funds for the people to improve their cities, finance education, and move out into the countryside, training the people in agriculture to be able to do a better job on these lands after the war when they're going to be available to them in some fashion or another, whether it's going to be tax-free land to start with, and then gradually you put property taxes back on as they become productive, that we can't be certain. But that was my program along these lines as I outlined it last night.
You mean by land taxation, land value taxation?
Land value taxation.
Specifically.
May 28, 1967.
Mr. Beecher.
General Wheeler, there have been a number of confusing statements on infiltration of troops from North Vietnam to South Vietnam. General Westmoreland, who's out there, says that more than 8,000 a month on the average came down last year into South Vietnam, whereas Secretary McNamara told Congress that his estimate was roughly half that, or about 4,500 a month in 1966, and he said it seemed to have dropped appreciably toward the end of the year. My question is this, is infiltration up or is it way down?
Now, of course, this is about the most difficult question that's been asked today, Mr. Beecher. In the first place, it takes from 3 to 6 months to be absolutely sure that you have identified a unit without fail after it comes into from North Vietnam into South Vietnam. In other words, there's a 3 to a 6 months lag in your figures. The figures available to us indicate that in the first and second quarters of calendar 1966, infiltration was at a very high level. Higher in the first quarter, not quite as high in the second quarter. In the third quarter, it dropped off again. And of course, as I said, in the fourth quarter, our figures are still not good enough for us to consider them to be worthy of saying we know the answer. I would say that the figures available as of now, with the lessening in the detected rate of infiltration from the first to the second to the third quarter, does indicate a leveling off of the forces in South Vietnam. I'm afraid that's the best I can do with that one.
General Wheeler, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, February 26, 1967. And the following is Secretary Vance, Deputy Secretary of Defense, the second in command at the Pentagon. The date is May 28, 1967.
Mr. Norman.
I'd like to ask you, Mr. Vance, about the infiltration reports that you get at the Pentagon. For some reason or other, infiltration seems to have dropped to such a low level that it's not even being reported. The figure for January was roughly about 100 or 200. There was a tentative figure for February a month ago, and then the February figure has disappeared completely. Have the VC disappeared from their infiltration routes, or what is happening?
Well, as you know, Mr. Norman, this whole question of infiltration is a very tricky one. Figures are given out, and people accept them as being precise and accurate. They can never be precise and accurate. Now, coming to your specific question, the figures which we do have would indicate that there has been some falling off in infiltration during the last several months. To what one would attribute this, I am not sure. It could be that our bombing is taking an effect. It could be that this is just a deliberate decision on the part of the North Vietnamese.
I'm also interested in, despite the drop-off of infiltration and despite the very heavy casualties, the strength of the VC and North Vietnamese forces continues to rise. It's now about 292,000. About a year ago, it was 270 or 260,000. Is there something about this force that seems to grow from within, or is it all coming from across the border, Cambodia, Laos, and the DMZ?
I would say the bulk of it is coming from without South Vietnam. The bulk of it has been coming down from North Vietnam through Laos into South Vietnam.
Mr. Coyne.
Today on Face the Nation, Roger Hilsman, Assistant Secretary of State for Far Eastern Affairs in the Kennedy administration.
June 4th, 1967.
Members of the administration who feel the same way you do, that the bombing is unnecessary and unproductive?
Well, I'm no longer a member of the administration, haven't been for 3 years, so I couldn't really say that, except again, looking at the public record, I think that quite apart, you must understand, I'm neither a dove nor a hawk. I was all in favor of the United States staying in Vietnam. What I've been not in favor of is making it an American war or internationalizing the war by bombing the North. I would say that on the public record, the evidence is that certainly a lot of very serious and responsible congressmen and senators would share this view. And also, I understand from you gentlemen and reading your accounts that there are some in the administration who privately, at least, would share these doubts.
Mr. Hilsman, as a doc, and if you were back, in government, would your recommendation to the president now be to stop the bombing?
Yes, it would, both on military grounds and on political grounds.
Could you spell those out?
I'll try as briefly as I can. I was a guerrilla leader in World War II. Air power was on our side there, but I think from a guerrilla's point of view, in an underdeveloped country, the targets are not decisive. Of course, the bombing of the North hurts the North. It makes it more costly for the North. There's no doubt of this. But it's not decisive in the sense that, as Secretary McNamara has said, it will not stop them from getting as many men in as they want to get in. It will just make it more costly in both lives and treasury. It will not stop them from getting supplies in. On the other hand, because of it, you see, we have, because there are so few targets, they are able to put up enormous anti-aircraft defenses. And I think on the military side of the equation, the cost in highly trained men, in their lives, in machines, in airplanes, in bombs, is out of all proportion to the military gain. That's the military side. On the political side, I think you have to put it in its world context. We've not only lost the confidence of many of our allies and many of the neutral nations in the world, we have lost a feeling of confidence in our sense of responsibility and our sense of restraint. But more than that, we've put the Soviet Union and maybe soon China in a position that is intolerable for them. The Soviet Union is in the position of not being able to defend a, quote, socialist ally. As a consequence, the Soviet aid program in North Vietnam went from really just a token aid program before the bombing to something like $1 billion or $2 billion a year. I don't have the figures right on my head, but something like that. Mainly in anti-aircraft, but in a lot of other things. In other words, we're dragging them into a commitment on the communist side. The same with the Chinese.
On Vietnam, which is a more dangerous, I think, situation, although they're both dangerous, strikes me that a very proper way to proceed there would be, in view of the frustrations of bilateral negotiations and many other efforts, that the Security Council should recommend, and I would hope it would be unanimous, although it probably wouldn't be, that it should recommend that the Vietnamese matter should be returned to its original home, which was Geneva, in the Geneva Conference. And they recommend at the same time that the bombing be stopped in the north, which has been stated on many occasions as being a prerequisite to a reconvening of that conference. That conference could be reconvened and ways and means examined to implement the provisions of the original protocol developed here in Geneva. And there's been many changes. There may be some additional changes. But if I understand it properly, at least at some times, that's not necessarily today, or the North Vietnamese, I think the Viet Cong, or the NLF, if you like, and the Chinese have at various times stated that they thought this should be resolved on the basis of the original Geneva Conference.
Well, there are many harsh things said about the United States today, and really very few kind things. And actually, our record in the last 20 years in peacekeeping and in life widening is one of which we can be proud and we're not ashamed. Many of us as senators may have individual disagreements on individual aspects of policy, but I think that we should keep the whole picture in perspective. And the problem in Vietnam, to be specific, is one that needs solution and needs cooling. And our job here is to turn the torrent of words that will come out of this convocation into a sluice that will turn a little bit the wheel of progress towards peace. And in this spirit, I leave with you my own personal plan that I said on the floor of the Senate 6 days ago, and I would like to see in discussion. As a first step, I believe we should cease bombing the North and hold our present level of men in the South, at the same time seeking either North Vietnamese assurance or some responsible third party guarantee that the North Vietnamese will not increase their level of men in the South and will negotiate and agree upon a ceasefire and an end of violence to be followed by four things. First, a verified free election with candidates for office and right to vote open to every citizen of South Vietnam. Second, in accordance with the principle of self-determination, the internal affairs of South Vietnam, including reunification and constitutional issues to be settled by the South Vietnam government resulting from that election. Third, agreement in principle to eventual complete American withdrawal of troops and withdrawal in fact based on completion of arrangements leading to the election, replacement by Asian troops, and the withdrawal of North Vietnamese forces. And fourth, immediate release of all political prisoners, amnesty for any political actions in the past, and most important, asylum for any South Vietnamese wishing it. The final objective would be a general military neutralization of the whole area, as once proposed by President de Gaulle. And these Pacifics, which seek to try to follow the old diplomatic adage of exchanging what we think is a knife for what the other man thinks is a, rather, what we think is a pawn the other man thinks is a knife, are the kind of ideas I hope might come out of this conference. Thank you.
Senator Claiborne Pell at the Geneva Conference, May 1967. The following is Foreign Minister Tran Van Do of South Vietnam, May 1967.
Mr. Minister, had South Vietnam been seated at this convention in Geneva, what exactly would South Vietnam have proposed to end the war?
If I can expose at the conference, I'd like to repeat what we already said 2 years ago about our solution to Vietnam War. I'm to say that we propose to return to the Geneva Agreement 54, to maintain the 17th parallel last demarcation line between North and South, and a regrouping of armed force in both sides of the demarcation line, and the control by an international commission. We may have the ICC or an enlarged and reinforced ICC or any international organization can control, but provide control must be effective to control the ceasefire. And then Afterwards, when peace will be really restored with the cessation of austerity and sabotage, and then we'll have a peaceful coexistence with North Vietnam, with Laos and Cambodia. We may have economic exchange. That's in a nutshell what I propose to the conference.